Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance, go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the June 10th, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Well, thanks for tuning in to this weekly program about our nation's space program. I invite you to stick around for the next hour as we touch on a variety of subjects related to what's going up, what's going on, and sometimes what's not going on in space, not only here at Cape Canaveral, but at points around the globe. My guest today will include George Diller from the Kennedy Space Center, who will give us an update on the planned launch this week of NASA's New Star telescope from an Army missile range in the Pacific. And then we'll talk with a very impressive young lady named Laura Seward, who helped organize a car wash and bake sale fundraiser that was held yesterday near the University of Central Florida. What does that have to do with the space program? Well, stay tuned and we'll tell you all about it. And if that weren't enough, I will tell you a little bit about my visit this past week to our nation's capital, where I got the chance to see Space Shuttle Discovery on display at the Udvar-Hazy facility in Virginia. Hey, plus your questions and comments about anything having to do with our space program are welcome as well. Today along the way, please feel free to give us a call anytime during the program. Send us an email if you'd like. No question too dumb, no opinion not worthy of discussion. Our phone number is 768-1240. The area code is 321 if you need it. And our email address, as always, is spacetalking@AOL.com. Well, let's get started with today's edition of my weekly broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. 25 years ago, I graduated from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach. Now, when you attend an aviation-themed school an hour's drive north of the Kennedy Space Center, you wind up with college buddies who are a mix of propeller heads and space cadets, and are generally kind of nerdy in a likable Star Trek convention kind of way. If you watch The Big Bang Theory on TV, then you have met the personalities of some of my closest lifelong friends. When we were all in school back during the mid-1980s, the movie The Right Stuff had just made its first run in theaters, and there was no greater cinematic epic at that time for all of us at Embry-Riddle, and especially for those of us working on the student newspaper there called The Avion. My first writing job for The Avion in the fall of 1984 was a 10-part weekly series on the history of the space program up through the Apollo-Soyuz test project, or as they like to say in Russia, the Soyuz-Apollo test project. And it all began with the premise that, quote, "You've seen the right stuff. Now find out what happened next." Well, my first party with the gang at the Avion was a right stuff party in which I dressed as Werner von Braun and my wife dressed as Trudy Cooper, complete with scarf and white gloves, a fashion statement, I might add, that I keep hoping will return thanks to AMC's Mad Men, but so far no luck. We watched the right stuff. We talked about the movie. And we worked quotes from the movie into our conversations with each other whenever we could. And in fact, we still do. We would hear of NASA budget cuts to the space station and tell each other, "Hey, no bucks, no Buck Rogers." Or one of us would suggest something and we'd debate it and argue about it amongst ourselves. And then inevitably, someone would say, "What Gus is saying here is we got to stick together on this thing." But my favorite quote to this day is the one that we repeated after someone would say something that he had heard many times before that we'd all heard, and maybe we were a little sick of it and wanted to make fun of it, yet at the same time, it had just enough truth to it and that by saying the line, we were showing support in our own way. What's that line? Well, during the right stuff, in the scene where the Mercury astronauts are introduced during a press conference, after John Glenn and Gordon Cooper had pontificated with inspirational words about how their family supports them and how important this effort is to the nation, and then seeing how the news media is just eating it up and how all the girls are crying, Gordo asks Deke Slayton if he agrees, and Deke says, "I agree absolutely with Gordo, but I don't think we're saying anything new here. I think we're just saying the same things that need to be said again and again with fierce conviction." So with that long introduction, I want to make the following point. Our space program is not dead. This past week, I visited Washington, D.C. for some meetings at NASA headquarters. On the way to the airport to come home on Friday, the cab driver talked about how his family had once visited Huntsville, Alabama, and saw the U.S. Space and Rocket Center there, and then said to me, "What a shame it was that we were shutting down our space program." I held myself back. I took a deep breath. And then I reminded him that six humans, two of them U.S. astronauts, are in orbit right now aboard the International Space Station. A probe called Curiosity is on its way to land on Mars in 2 months. NASA plans to launch a small telescope into orbit this week. I told him that we had just completed the first cargo or commercial cargo delivery mission to the space station, an event that bodes well for future commercial opportunities, including ferrying humans into and out of space on American rockets. I told him that while we don't really know what to do with them yet, this past week NASA was given pieces of two spy satellites from the National Reconnaissance Office that, if assemblies completed and launched, would be just as powerful and important to science, if not more so, than the Hubble Space Telescope. And while I didn't say this to the cab driver, I'll remind you about two other events that happened just this week, namely Shuttle Enterprise's barge trip through New York Harbor to be delivered to the Intrepid aircraft carrier, and Tuesday night's transit of Venus across the face of the sun. Now, both were space-related news that made headlines around our nation and the world, and showed once again how fascinated people are with spaceflight. In fact, I was at the National Air and Space Museum on Tuesday as the transit began, and the place was packed with people waiting in line just to see a picture of the thing on a giant TV screen because it was cloudy over Washington. The bottom line, people still are interested in space. The Kennedy Space Center and the rest of our space program remains open for business. Astronauts are in space right now. People everywhere continue to benefit in their daily lives because of space-related innovations. We're staying busy. We could always be doing more. Our space program is not dead. But of course, we're not saying anything new here. We're just saying the same things that need to be said again and again with fierce conviction. And that's this week's Orbital Inclinations. Hey, before we take our first break, I'd like to acknowledge the passing this week of one of the great fantasy and science fiction writers of our modern space age, Ray Bradbury, very well known for his books such as Fahrenheit 451, The Illustrated Man, Something Wicked This Way Comes, and of course my favorite, The Martian Chronicles. You may not know this, but Bradbury was very close to Walt Disney. He was very involved in the construction and storyline of Spaceship Earth at Epcot. He wrote nearly 50 books and more than 600 short stories, and his words and ideas will endure for generations to come. Well, now when we come back, we'll hear from NASA's George Diller about plans to launch New Star this week from the Kwajalein Atoll in the Pacific. And don't forget your comments and questions welcome. Give us a call, 321-768-1240, email spacetalking@AOL.com. Stay tuned. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. 321-768-1240 is the number to call to participate in the program today, or you can send us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, as we previewed on this program a few weeks ago, a small NASA science telescope is scheduled for launch on a Pegasus rocket this Wednesday at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Only we won't be able to see it here on the Space Coast because the launch is taking place on the other side of the planet over the Pacific Ocean. Nevertheless, this is an official Kennedy Space Center launch. So I want to make sure we pay close attention to what our friends and neighbors at KSC are up to. To help us do that today is the legendary George Diller from NASA Public Affairs, who joins us from his home by phone. George, how are you doing today?
Hi, good afternoon, Jim.
Wonderful to have you back. We talked with you and Garrett Skrobot a few weeks ago about the New Star mission.
Right.
Kind of previewed it and all that. But let's get up to date. What's going on?
Garrett Skrobot is out at Kwajalein right now with the rest of the launch team. It's a combined NASA and Orbital Sciences launch team that went out to Kwajalein, flew from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California to Kwajalein on a chartered 737. There were 49 members of the launch team on that 737 that went out there last week, along with the orbital L-1011 carrier aircraft that had the Pegasus attached to the bottom of it. So it was actually a two-day ferry flight, and they got out there about the end of last week, and since then have been getting the rocket ready to fly. And yesterday they had a countdown dress rehearsal, and that involved both the NASA Launch Services Program team as well as Orbital's team and the range at Reagan Test Site, which is actually part of the Army Kwajalein Missile Range.
Right.
So that countdown went well. It's a combination of an exercise where they throw in simulated problems, but at the same time they also work real problems that came up. So they had some of both, and they felt like they had a really good exercise yesterday, and they're in a good position for a launch on Wednesday. So the launch readiness review is going to be tomorrow afternoon. But we've also got part of the launch team that stayed here in the Mission Director's Center at Cape Canaveral.
Right.
And part of the launch will be managed from here. And so that was part of the exercise as well. We had a team in NASA's Hangar AE where a lot of the data will be coming back from the flight as well.
So you're taking advantage of satellites, and I'm going to guess TDRS, but maybe it's something else to
relay. That's exactly right. TDRS will be participating, especially after the spacecraft comes off the rocket. The big challenge, I think, in this between having a part of the team here and a part of the team in Kwajalein is that there's a 13-hour time difference. But it kind of works out to our advantage because the launch is at 11:30 in the morning, our time, local time.
Right.
But in Kwajalein, it's 3:30 in the morning out there. So it's a deep overnight countdown operation for them.
So your circadian rhythm isn't goofed up, but theirs is royally a jet lag right
there
now.
It is. And that's why after tomorrow when they have the launch readiness review, Tuesday is a day off. They call it a crew sync day that they have time to sleep and rest up and then come in for the launch on Tuesday night, Wednesday morning.
Well, how does the weather look like? And when you're talking about airdropping a Pegasus from the Stargazer L-1011, I'm sure that you can maneuver a little bit within a certain range of weather. What's the story there?
Well, it's it looked like around a 20 or 30% chance of having a weather problem. The weather out there, it doesn't look too bad next week. So we're pretty optimistic there. But the good thing is that we've got a four-hour launch opportunity. So if once they get down, they ferry about 125 miles from Kwajalein down to about 6 degrees latitude, very near the equator.
Right.
And once they get down there, they enter this racetrack pattern. And if they run into any issues, then they just stay in the racetrack because they got plenty of time to get it off. And if they have a weather issue or some kind of a technical issue, is there's not something like, you know, we do here sometime where we've got a one-second window and it's got to go or it's not going.
Sure.
So they got some flexibility there. But the weather doesn't look too bad at the moment.
Yeah, I suppose if you're dropping it, what is it, 35,000 feet?
39,000.
39,000.
Yeah, 39,000 plus or minus 500 feet.
You're pretty much above most of the nasty stuff.
That's exactly right.
So, and now that you're going out of Kwajalein, this is not new. I want to kind of stress that point too, that NASA has done this before, and if I'm not mistaken, Orbital Sciences has done this on other non-NASA missions.
That's correct. They've had missions down there both for NASA and for other government entities and commercial entities. So it's something that they're fairly accustomed to doing, and the success down there has been good. And what they're trying to do is to be able to take advantage of launching at a very low latitude to use the physics of the spinning of the Earth to help propel it into orbit, which means you can use less fuel or a smaller rocket and carry a heavier payload. So that's what the intent of going down there is.
Yeah, as opposed to a Kennedy Space Center launch taking place off our coast here.
That's correct. Now, we have done Pegasus launches here from the Cape, but it depends on the mission, and this one was ideally suited for Kwajalein because of the size of the payload and where we wanted to go with it.
Well, we tend to be focused on launch operations and the rockets because we're all a bunch of steely-eyed missile men, George, but let's talk about the payload and the mission. Give us the highlights of what NuSTAR is all about.
Yeah, NuSTAR, it's kind of a nested acronym that stands for Nuclear Spectroscopic Telescope Array. It's a telescope that's custom designed to have some unique capability. It's an X-ray telescope that has a unique focusing capability that gives it improved sensitivity for better images. It's really two telescopes that together can be focused. So much like you've got a pair of binoculars or opera glasses, you know how you put them up to your eyes and then you focus one eye, then you focus them both together,
sure.
And you get a really sharp image. Well, that's what NuSTAR is going to be able to do. So it's going to be scanning the Milky Way to look for remnants of exploded stars such as white dwarfs and neutron stars and black holes. And the black holes are kind of its forte in our galaxy and other galaxies as well, because those emit very high-energy X-rays that tend to cluster near the center of galaxies. So this particular telescope is particularly suited for seeking those out.
So, length of the mission, science team back somewhere?
Yes, there's a science team at Berkeley,
okay,
in California, and this mission is actually under Caltech, California Institute of Technology in California, as well as Berkeley and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So they're the ones behind the science, and the spacecraft will be controlled from Berkeley.
Now, there was some interest, George, among some of the Space Talk fans out there in two topics. The first one being just to talk a little bit about the delay that we experienced in this launch over concerns about software. Can you briefly touch on that?
Well, there were two things that we were doing that caused us to want to push the launch downstream, and that was so that we felt like we had better mission assurance, confidence that the mission was going to be completely successful. The first one was that we had a first flight item on this particular Pegasus, and it's a new flight computer and all of the software that goes along with that flight computer. And as we worked through some of the launch simulations and some of the testing of the computer, we felt like the software needed some additional refining. So that it looked like it would work,
right,
but we felt like we could have added confidence if we spent some more time with it. So that's what they did. So we have a new flight software package loaded into this new flight computer,
okay,
that now we feel we have a lot of confidence in that new very sophisticated flight computer that's on this Pegasus Orbital XL. The other thing was that we've never had a problem on the Pegasus with the fairing not coming off the way we did on Taurus, but there were some similarities there that we felt like, even though there's never been a problem, we needed to start looking under some rocks. And so when we did, we saw some areas where we felt like we could improve the fairing separation to give us better confidence that we wouldn't have any concerns that the fairing would come off as it's intended to. Even though we've never had a problem with it, we saw areas where we could enhance that confidence. So that's what we did. Those were the two things, that we enhanced our confidence in the flight computer and the software, and also in the fairing separation mechanism.
And with just a little less than a minute to go, George, everyone wants to know, have you got your liftoff line, and is communication between you and Kwajalein such that you won't do like I did with the abort of the SpaceX launch and call liftoff before this time?
Are you being funny, Tim?
you know, it's kind of funny. When we read all the stories about the abort the day after, it was only your close friends in the news media that called, that pointed that out in their stories, that we had said liftoff before we were supposed to.
I'll tell you, we got down to half a second. I don't think I've ever seen a cutoff as close as half a second before launch. So that came in to get us. But anyway, the one thing that's interesting about the Pegasus is that even though we'll get down to the T0 and the drop time, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to drop and light off at that instant, because it's based on when the aircraft is precisely aligned with the trajectory. It's going
to
fly.
And George, we're going to have to cut it there, so I know you're going to say it at the right time. Thanks, George. Good luck to everyone. Everyone stand by as we pause now for our five-minute built-in hold. At the bottom of the hour, we'll be back after news, weather, and sports, talk about some fundraising activities in Orlando. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
And indeed, welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. Our phone lines and online inbox are open for your questions or comments. The phone number is 321-768-1240. The email address is spacetalking@AOL.com. Before we go to our next guest, we have Carrie joining us on the phone with a question about the Falcon 9. Good afternoon, Carrie.
Hi.
How you doing today?
I was all right, but I'm starting to get over it after all that rain.
What's up?
I'd like to talk about the failure of the Falcon 9.
Which failure is that? Because it was a pretty successful flight.
The one that just went.
Yeah? What about
it? It came back without Fruit Loops.
It came back without Fruit Loops.
Okay. I caught you the other day.
Is that it? All right. Take care, Carrie. I actually get that. So, anyway, okay, well, cool. Hey, yesterday, Carrie, thanks. Yesterday, near the University of Central Florida, go Knights. My next guest managed a car wash and bake sale fundraiser that, believe it or not, had everything to do with our space program. Laura Seward is a graduate student at UCF, the current president of our local Central Florida chapter of the National Space Society, and, in my opinion, destined to be one of the great leaders of our space program in this century. Laura, how you doing this afternoon?
Doing great. Thank you for that, Jim.
Well, thanks for joining us. You had a busy day yesterday. Tell us about how a car wash and a bake sale has something to do with the space program.
Well, this idea was conceived back with the Viking program. Some people got together and held a similar event when the Viking program was starting to be cut, and it worked. And so Alan Stern of the Southwest Research Institute came up with this idea to raise money, actually raise awareness about the recent budget cuts, recent proposed budget cuts in the Planetary Sciences and Planetary Exploration programs in NASA. And so he got this idea of doing just a fun event that would raise a lot of attention, get people interested, get people talking about it. And in that sense, it was a highly successful event. We had so much publicity, we had so many people come out, and it was just a fantastic time.
Yeah, let's break that down a little bit. So Viking, of course, the Mars lander way back in the 70s, and a very similar thing happened. Your intent here, Alan Stern's intent, and all the groups that were part of this, I think some of this was a little misread by some of the news media. You weren't trying to make money to pay for a planetary science program, but you were trying to use these activities, as you said, to raise awareness. And so talk about how you were able to do that yesterday over at UCF, and what kind of success did you have in the people showing up?
Yeah, that's correct. Our intent was to raise awareness. We weren't actually intending to make money. Our event was donation only, and so we actually accepted enough donations to exactly cover the cost of the event. So that worked out perfectly. We collected roughly 275 letters. I have to count them again, but about that many to send to Congress. So we're sending them to five different members of Congress who are on the Appropriations Committee, because right now the NASA budget is in the appropriations process, and those are the key people who will have control over how much money NASA will get in fiscal year 2013. So that's what we wanted to do, was to tell these members of Congress that the general public cares about NASA, cares about the Planetary Exploration Program, cares about NASA's future and the future of our country. And so in that sense, it was really great. We had a lot of people turn out. We had a lot of news coverage, both before the event and during. We had four local broadcast stations there. And then the day before, we had a international news, actually.
Yeah.
It was fantastic. We had a lot of people who heard about it and a lot of people who didn't even know about it who just stopped by because they thought it was an interesting event.
You know, you did a great job on the publicity. You know, your name appeared in quite a few stories, international and nationally. Let's see, when I tried to Google up some current news coverage, I got as far as Laura S. on Google, and I think Seward was the second reference right away. So I was like, you were all over the place, which is great. And so since you, in a way, you became kind of a de facto spokesperson for some of this stuff, which was, I think, really neat as well. Talk a little bit about this planetary science cut. You know, I think $300 million is the magic number that everyone's been using. You know,
yes,
what do we not get because we're not going to do that full funding?
Well, there were several things that were cut or proposed to be cut. For example, the Mars mission that would have been a joint mission between NASA and ESA, that has been cut or significantly downsized. They haven't quite made a decision yet on whether they're going to try to have a much lower cost mission in 2018, 2020, something like that.
Right, right.
They haven't made that decision yet. But the big flagship mission that was supposed to be a joint mission between NASA and ESA, that was cut, as well as cutting some funding for the middle and the lower cost missions, the Discovery class and the New Frontiers class missions. You know, NASA's program in planetary exploration is the most successful in the entire world. We've invested so much into it and gotten more return than we could have expected. It's a golden age for planetary science. So we really want to continue that investment. We want to put forward the money now, put forward the programs now, so that 5-10 years from now, we will still be getting fantastic information, especially if we're going to go to Moon, Mars, and asteroids. We need to know about the Moon, the Mars, and asteroids.
Sure.
We need to know about them if we're actually going to send humans to these places. So we need to have a very strong planetary science program now if we're actually going to go out as humans and explore the solar system.
Well, and I think you have a great balance in the message. So many people in both the human spaceflight community and the planetary science community want to make it an either-or proposition. You either send robots, you send humans, and you can't afford to do both. And clearly you're trying to afford to do both here, and I think you've got the right idea. You personally, I think, feel that as you said, both the robots and the humans are necessary to do space exploration in its fullest.
Yes, yeah, I personally believe, I'm a planetary scientist, and so I absolutely love everything that our planetary program does with the probes and rovers, and I think that's fantastic. I want us to keep doing that. And I work, actually just started working on a small project with a group at KSC, and they are big into using robotics and humans to go ahead and colonize the solar system. And I think that's essential. I think we need both to be able to do that. I think we need both just to even go and visit, because we're doing some studies on how to land on Mars. And it turns out you cannot land humans on Mars without some kind of launch pad. And so you need robotics to first build the launch pad before you can land humans
sure.
on Mars.
Sure.
This is something that we've newly figured out. So both go together so strongly you can't cut one or the other. They have to go together.
Well, and I don't know how much of the politics you want to get into, but, you know, the $300 million that's being cut, a lot of people are saying that it's the James Webb telescope that's eating everything up at the sacrifice of some of these other programs. Do you have any thoughts on those kind of lines of thinking?
We strongly support all of the NASA's programs. We want to see them all succeed. So I very much hope that James Webb succeeds. I very much hope that the planetary program continues to do some great work and also succeeds. You know, I don't think it's mutually exclusive. I think that
sure.
both can be successful, and it's not all about money either. It's also about managing time, managing the money, managing the resources that we have.
Laura, tell us a little bit about yourself, and I've always been very impressed with you and continue to be so. You've got a great background. You've done a lot of different things. You've been exposed to high G and low G and every other form of G, it seems. Talk about what your background and why do you care about all this? What fascinates you about all of this that you're so involved, not only from a technical standpoint, but But from this outreach and management, I mean, you've got both sides of your brain firing off here.
Thank you for the compliment. I am about a year away from getting my doctorate in planetary sciences at UCF, University of Central Florida. I did a stint in Huntsville. I got my master's there. Before that, I was back here at the Space Coast at Florida Institute of Technology, got my bachelor's there. You know, so I've worked in several locations and gone from high-energy astrophysics to now planetary sciences, and I love human exploration. I'm a member of the National Space Society, which is very strongly advocating, you know, colonization, settlement of sure. the solar system. This is my passion. This has always been my passion since as long as I can remember.
Do you know what kicked that off, Laura? I mean, was it any one particular incident or experience that you
all
had as a
kid? All I can remember is that back in first grade, I wrote a story about visiting the moon. So it must have been at least by then. I really don't know. My parents are both lawyers, so they wonder where I got it.
I know that feeling, too, and my kids kind of wonder where I got it as well. So now going forward, what do you hope to do as a graduate? You're off to JPL. Is that the only place? Is that the best place? What would you want to do with this?
I have several options. I guess it will just depend on what options are presented to me about a year from now. So if any of your listeners have any suggestions, I'm well open to them.
Good networking capability, right? Well, that's great. Hey, now talk a little bit, too, about the National Space Society. I've been a member for a long time and was involved in L5 when I was at Embry-Riddle and all of that. You're very involved in our Central Florida chapter, the current president. Talk about the opportunities that the National Space Society has to share the story here, and how can people locally get involved in your organization?
Locally, we have a local chapter that has actually grown so much in the past few months. We started with 3 members. We're now up to about 30, so we've grown 10 times the amount.
Right, which is a great number, by the way, yeah.
So we hold monthly, we call them space local events. That means that we bring in people who are working locally in the space program to both have a discussion with us and to open up the floor. So it's almost like a roundtable discussion. The expert starts off the discussion, and then we just have, you know, see where the conversation flows from there. So it's very informal. Those are on Cocoa Beach, Courtyard Marriott, every either first or second Saturday at 2:00, depending on the month.
Sure.
And those are usually posted on our Facebook group, if you have Facebook events, and also on Twitter. And, yeah, so come out. They're open to anybody. It's all about opening up space to the general public. That's what National Space Society does. It's a grassroots organization. So you can be an expert in the space program, or you can be a brand-new beginner. You can bring your kids. You can bring your, you know, anybody can come and talk about it. You do not need to be an expert. You do not need to be a professional. But professionals are, of course, welcome.
That's great. Laura, thank you so much, and congratulations on a great event and the publicity. We'll be in touch with you. I know we'll be hearing more from you in the future, and then good luck with finishing your graduate degree. Appreciate it very much. Hey, everybody, stand by as we take our final break of the day. And when we come back, we'll wrap up our discussions here. We'll talk a little bit about the Udvar-Hazy facility up in Washington. I'm Jim Behnke. Hey, you're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. Oprah. Rush Limbaugh, weekdays noon to 3 on WMMB. And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back as we do begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk, with a quick reminder that you can stay in touch with us throughout the week. If you're on Facebook, just search for Space Talk. If you're on Twitter, then the name to look for is Space Talking. And all the time for one-stop shopping, just visit WMMBAM.com, keywords Space Talk. And as we do continue along with the program today, let's do take a moment for our weekly look at the local launch forecast. Well, there has been no change to the forecast since last week. It's almost something like a Florida summer forecast. It's the same thing every day. In any case, plans for the next launch from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station is the next launch targeted for June 18th. A United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket is to fly from Complex 41 with a secret satellite for the National Reconnaissance Office. And we don't know when the launch time will be. They'll announce that a few days before launch, so we'll just kind of keep an eye on things, let you know when we know. For more information about all the various launches scheduled around the world, including coverage of the Falcon 9. I'm so used to saying that. Of the Pegasus launch of the new Star probe that we just talked about with George Diller. Just jump onto the web to WMMBAM.com, keyword space talk. Look for the link to the left that's launch forecast. From there, you get to the Mitel Solutions website for everything you need to know about what's going on. Well, look, as we wrap up today's program, I did want to spend a little time talking about my trip to Washington this past week. Had some business up at NASA headquarters, but it also afforded me a chance to get over to the Air and Space Museum on the National Mall, and then finally, after all these years, up to the Udvar-Hazy facility next to Dulles International, where I did get the chance to see Space Shuttle Discovery in all its glory. I'll tell you a little bit about that. To help me talk about what's going on up there and what it's like, one of those aforementioned friends from the Avion we talked about at the beginning of the program, my good friend Brian Nicholas, who works with the Air and Space Museum here on an unofficial capacity as my college buddy to talk about this. Brian, how you doing today?
Good.
Good. Hey, thanks for being on the phone for a few minutes. It was good to see you last week. Finally got a chance to get up to Udvar-Hazy, and I think the first question before we talk about Discovery for you is, you know, can you tell us where the name came from? I mean, everyone always has so much trouble pronouncing it. Udvar-Hazy is who?
Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy.
Yeah.
He's a gentleman who made his name and made his fortune in the aircraft leasing business. International Lease Finance Corporation is what he is connected to at this point.
And is he Belgian? Is that Belgian? Is that what I remember reading somewhere?
Hungarian, I believe.
Hungarian. So the man was pretty much the benefactor, a big benefactor for making this facility happen. So it's Udvar-Hazy, in case you want to learn how to pronounce it, Udvar-Hazy. So, Brian, I walk in. Our good friend Wes Olszewski took me and Christopher, my son Christopher, up to see the thing. We walk in the building, and you walk on the sort of this platform out to oversee over like a balcony overlooking the whole thing. Udvar-Hazy is a T-shaped facility where kind of all the aircraft are along the one end, and then sort of this thing sticks out, and it's the space hangar, the McDonnell Space – or is it the Boeing or McDonnell, Brian?
It's the McDonnell Space Hangar and I believe the Boeing Aircraft Hangar.
And the Boeing Aircraft Hangar. So you see Discovery sitting out there. You walk into this balcony, and you see the SR-71 Blackbird, the famous supersonic spy plane. And behind it, you see kind of the top of Discovery. And I got to admit, it was a very emotional thing for me to see. I actually teared up for a little bit. And then we finally got down to see it. And it was an amazing thing. Brian, talk a little bit about how Discovery sits there and kind of what's surrounding it.
Well, the space hangar is almost designed to fit a shuttle. So Discovery is pride of place. And around it, on as you enter the space hangar, and Discovery's nose is right in front of your nose, on your right-hand side are various missiles and rockets. There's anything from World War II, some German missiles, all the way up to some fairly modern stuff. There's an ASM-135 ASAT sitting there. And then on the left-hand side of Discovery, we have various space artifacts. Paraglider test vehicle for the Gemini program is sitting there.
I was very fascinated by that, the idea that the Gemini spacecraft originally was they'd hoped to land it. Pilots wanted to be pilots, so they wanted to fly this inflatable wing and land Gemini on a lake bed or on a runway or whatever, and it just didn't have time to work through it, and they went with the splashdown. Brian, the Gemini 7, is that the one I saw, the Gemini 7 capsule?
Yes, I believe so.
I think that's right. But what was neat to me was to see the a real Mercury capsule still with the retro package on, and like you could put the thing on top of the rocket and launch it. That would have been the capsule that Alan Shepard would have used to fly his orbital flight after Gordon Cooper's Phase 7 mission, had they allowed that to happen, and they didn't. They went right to Gemini. And so all these years later, that Mercury capsule winds up next to Discovery, and it was something else. But, Brian, I wanted to ask you, we're almost out of time, believe it or not, just about 45 seconds. Tell me about the people as you see, as you're working in that facility and you look down and you see people coming in. What are the faces like? What are the reactions like from people seeing Discovery?
Well, so far, it really hasn't been a whole lot of time since Discovery's sat there, but people tend to walk in, and you see them kind of walk in briskly because that's what they want to see, and then they stop short.
Yeah.
And just the immensity of an orbiter being in front of them, you know, just stops them in their track, and you can see kind of a look of awe in their face for the most part.
Wow. That's and everybody wants to pose next to the nose and take pictures, don't they?
Right. There's an angle to get where you get the nose and you get the name Discovery up high on the side of the fuselage, and that's the pose they want. That's the picture-taking spot, as it were.
That's great. Brian, I believe we're out of time. We need to spend more time with you and Valerie, your curator, as well, and talk some more about Discovery and all the neat things that are up there. But thanks for being out with me for a brief time, okay?
Certainly. Look forward to it, Jim.
Take care, Brian. Okay. So anyway, there goes Brian Nicholas. Hey, by the way, Discovery was great. It isn't where it should be, but where it is, I want to tell you all, it's in good hands. It's in great shape there. Hey, as we wrap up, I do want to tease you with some of the things going on, upcoming programs. In 2 weeks, on June 24th, we'll be joined by Homer Hickam, a retired NASA engineer from the Marshall Space Flight Center who wrote the best-selling book Rocket Boys. He just recently published another book called Crater, about a mining colony on the moon, a topic that is, well, certainly topical these days. In July, our guests are going to include former NASA astronaut Tom Jones, and in honor of the official 50th anniversary of the Kennedy Space Center, we're working to get the center director, Bob Cabana, on with us. We're just trying to nail down the date at that point, so lots going on in the weeks ahead. Don't forget that our inbox is open for you, spacetalking@AOL.com. Check out the website, WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, for everything that's going on with the program. That is all for now. Space Talk, a production of Mylas Solutions, and is brought to you thanks to the generous help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the ops station for today's program. It's been busy. Please join us next Sunday, 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight, for another live hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now as WMMB presents a weekend edition of the Best of Bill Mick Live. I'm Jim Bankey, and we will talk to you again real soon.